Yeah, we're far wealthier than we think. I mean, the potential is there. Well, for one reason, everybody says, well, what about oil? There's not enough oil to go around, or there's not enough food to go around. But the potential that we haven't developed, look at all the alternative energy ideas you hear, that the money is just not there to develop them. But if you put some money into it, you could solve all those energy problems. You could solve the food problems. You could do bioengineering, you know, where you put the plants together in such a way that you can feed your whole family with your front lawn or whatever. I mean, there are ways of raising food that's far more efficient than what we do now, but we don't put the money into developing those things because it's always all about short-term profits.
Hi, listeners. This is Martin with Kaput Radio. You just heard Alan Brown, and the show is about finance again.
Yeah.
But with a bit of related music interspersed, today there comes a constructive solution. I'm not saying that I'm totally agreeable on the mentioned statements here, but it is a continuation of sussing it all out. And thanks to James Corbett from GRTV.California for recording Alan Brown. Welcome to the show.
But if you understood what a credit system is, and let's say you have a public bank. So you have this idea for some alternative energy program. And you write that up as an asset on one side of your books. You figure out how much money it's going to cost. And then you write that into an account on the other side of your books. So you have the asset and the liability. You draw from that account, pay your workers, pay your materials, build the thing, and then the profits from the thing go back and pay off the loan. You can do that interest free. I mean, it's just an accounting thing and it's a government thing, so it's not like you're not taking any risk here. I mean, if it doesn't work out, the whole country is taking the risk, and we've agreed to that sort of investment. So if you it's been calculated that 50% of the cost of every project is interest. So if you took out the cost of interest, all these things that we think are not sustainable, like alternative energy, suddenly become not only sustainable, but actually profitable. So it's all just a matter of a shift in emphasis. Instead of money making money in the short term because we've got to have it to live, which allows these huge speculators to take huge amounts of money off the top and unbalance the whole system, if you make it all public and sort of community, it could work very well, and the numbers work out very well.
There's a fine line between investment grade and junk. There's a fine line between liquidity and a crunch. And you never know till you settle up if a credit is benign. There's a fine line between a gain and a painful decline. There's a fine line between the theories and the facts. And there's a fine line between what's solid and what cracks. And now my holdings badly misbehave, and my losses aren't confined. 'Cause there's a fine line between a gain and a painful decline. Years I piled on debt and smiled as my profits soared. Now I see that I can't be levered this much anymore. Bernanke, please save me. Cut rates, oh, I implore.
Open the darn Fed window. He has no idea how bad it is out there. He has no idea.
There's a fine line between a bull and a bear. And there's a fine, fine line between delight and despair. I'm hoping I'll avoid the pain to come from trades yet to unwind. But there's a fine, fine line between a game and a crippling, crushing, mortally wounding decline.
On Wall Street that they're doing?
Oh, Occupy Wall Street.
Right, Occupy Wall Street. So that started as a small, I mean, the first time they tried it, I think there were four people that actually were committed to stay. And then it just grew and grew and grew largely because of the internet. And you have your Arab Spring movements that have sort of prompted people around the world to do collective action. And it's something you can do through the internet. Hopefully we'll continue to have those lines of communication. But anyway, it is a time when the government is in control of the wrong side. And it's a legal means just, or I shouldn't say legal, we're not doing anything illegal, but political means are just very hard to work these days. So we may just have a lot of protest movements. I'm not really in favor of taking to the streets because it's you're dealing with it used to just be mace and now it's tasers and really dangerous things. Plus they don't televise it. I mean, you can be out there putting your life on the line and nobody even notices. But there are other ways. Well, for instance, here where if many people understood that their stock was being used against them and told their brokers that they did not want margin accounts, they want a regular account, it would take a lot of people to have an effect. But if everybody understood that and everybody did it, it's rather like the Move Your Money movement, it could have an effect. So that's just what we need to do is relay the information so everybody understands what the deal is here. You don't necessarily have to go out in the street and risk your life. You can just call your broker and set things right.
Absolutely. The idea of going out on Wall Street and trying to occupy it, I mean, I don't want to dismiss that or poo-poo it. I think it's important that people are getting involved and getting active in these types of things. But you're right. I mean, when we're facing a police state that's equipped with all of these LRADs and tasers and all of this new technology for suppressing dissent, I mean, I think the system is very much prepared for that type of action. But what they can't really control is our minds and our free will to go and take our money and put it where it will actually have a better effect and actually hopefully change society for the better. But then, of course, there's the larger sort of meta issue of the overall arching economy and the monetary system itself, which is really at the base of it. So it's really a huge behemoth to even begin to tackle.
So I would say the fundamental problem at the very bottom of the whole thing, the problem is our banking, the way the banking system's set up. It's not even that we have crooks taking advantage. I mean, you will always have crooks. As long as you have a system with flaws in it, people will find a way to make money out of it. But you have to fix the system. You have to plug the holes. And where the holes are is our whole system of thinking that money is a thing and that banks are private and that banks are actually lending things. They have to be able to expand the credit system because we have this whole parasitic system where they lend less money than they always take back more money than they put out. So somewhere the system has to grow. So what they're doing really is a big shell game where they're always pretending to have more money than they have. So they're lending it. They're lending out the deposits, but they tell the depositors that the money's still there. So they've double counted the deposits. And then when that money gets into another bank, they call it a deposit and they lend it out. So that's how the whole money supply grows. So the flaw is that we're considering money to be these objects that you count as an object. The way you could fix a system is to call it, acknowledge what it is, make it a public system. And so the bank is merely an accountant that's keeping track of who owes what to whom. And so it's just numbers, and you're just keeping track of numbers, and then allow the bank, which would be a public bank, in other words, it would be the public credit, allow the bank to issue credit to any creditworthy borrower. It doesn't depend on there being reserves here, or capital and reserves would be irrelevant in a public system, where what you're doing is actually monetizing your own promise to repay. You, the borrower, are creating the money in the sense that you're creating credit or debt, or you're drawing on the credit of the community. You're saying, trust me with your goods and services, and I will build something with them, and I will pay you back with some profit to you. So that's what the deal is. If the trust of the community doesn't require a stack of reserves over here, a pot of gold or a stack of deposits or any kind of backup, it's if the borrower is creditworthy and the community has the goods and services the borrower needs, they can get together and trade, and it's whether they have these little tickets that we call money should be irrelevant to that system.
How you doing out there, America? Is it just me? Or are you tired of going to the movies and paying $8.50 for a small popcorn? Daggone, I'm tired of it. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. Money's tight. Money's tight. Hello, my friend. 2010, coming in strong with my opinion about this U.S. economy and living in the what? The land of the free. Now, the land of the free is anything but, and I'm just a squirrel trying to get my nut, but it's very, very tough, and it's not very funny when everything in life costs a whole lot of money. Ooh. And if you come here from another country, let me tell you just exactly what you're gonna see as you drive down the passenger lane. Every 10 miles of road looks exactly the same. A closed up business, a closed up business. And hey, what's next to that? Another closed up business. And right next to that, 2 feet apart, you're gonna see a Mickey D's and an all-night Walmart. Ooh. Cause these enormous corporations move into tiny towns and tear up populations. Ooh. But I digress. Let me move a bit away from this mess and say that I do love the USA. And I know that I'm lucky to be here today. We'll exercise our freedom of speech and sing the chorus that you know we preach. I'm saying the American economy is killing me. It's tough to survive. Cause the American economy is killing me. Yo! Trying to save money's no fun, so here's a couple tips you can use to stretch out your George Washington. And it's tough, because the money that you make is not enough. I put my cruise on 3-5 when I drive, cause if I get another speeding ticket, it'd be hard to survive. Cause all that money that you spend on nothing could have went towards 100 Egg McMuffins. I give your girl a free back rub to please her. And when you're done with your gum, stick it up in the freezer. Ooh. So you can chew it later. And turn on your TV and you'll see Darth Vader. Cause they play Star Wars every day. And this is a cheap way to chill without spilling no pay. Ooh, this is how we do it. Have a life with your wife, just renew it. Get a movie for free at the library. Or you can watch E.T. or Rocky 3.
Yo, it's me, Sylvester Stallone. Adrian. I'm boxing. Here we go.
1, 2, patch the hole in your shoe. 3, 4, pick that nickel off the floor. 5, 6, people watch just for kicks. 7, 8, hopscotch is pretty great. 9, 10, ramen noodles again. Ooh, yeah, you got to do what it takes in this American economy. Yeah, yeah.
Who's got the money?
Somebody. The American economy is killing me. Blah, 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 blah.
We have 14 states with bills of one sort or another pending to look at the idea of a state-owned bank, either as a study or to actually form a bank. And the reason we wanted to form an institute, actually, we had this Google group going for several years, and we went back and forth on all the issues, and we finally got it nailed, and I finally thought I understood it well enough that I could go out there and talk about it and be an authority on it. And then we decided we understood the problem. Now it was time to get out there and take some action. So it's our grassroots organized movement. Is grassroots in the sense that we have no George Soros. We're totally volunteers in this organization, but committed volunteers, and we're working hard. So we've gotten the idea out there. It'll be a while, I think, before we see a real state bank. But one state has one. That's North Dakota. It's the only state that has beaten the credit crisis. I mean, they have not experienced a credit crisis at all. They've had a budget surplus every single year. They haven't lost a single bank in over a decade. They have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, something like 3%. They had the lowest default rate on loans, and they have fewer big out-of-state banks and more public or more local banks than other states. So some people say, well, it's because they've got oil, but Alaska, for example, is the same size as North Dakota and has twice as much oil, but they are doing less well. They have a 7% unemployment rate. So even though North Dakota has resources, it's the bank that provides the infrastructure. That it's not enough to just have these resources in the ground. You need credit, and you need access to credit in order to have the businesses that can profit and turn those resources into something that can be used. So that's what they've got. They've got a credit system that works.
Another day, another dollar. I'm on the way. Another day, another dollar. Working my whole life away.
It raises the question of how that credit system that works came about at all, because obviously that type of system is anathema to the privately owned central banks and the private bankers who want to keep this system for themselves and for their own purposes. And I think anyone who's done a serious study of the economic history of the United States has seen that basically it's been a long battle between people who wanted to institute things like that and people who wanted the private banking institutions to control the issuance of money. And I think that that's been a battle that we've seen played out for a long time and was really the central core issue of a lot of American politics until the formation of the Fed in 1913, at which the issue was seemed to be settled and it sort of disappeared from the media and the education system. But so it raises the question of how did this state-owned bank come about, and how did it really get going?
Yeah. Well, there have been state-owned banks that have come about before, but they usually get squelched eventually. I think the reason this one has lasted for 90 years is they did work it out so that it's a public-private arrangement, that the publicly owned state bank services the local banks. But those are the banks that are suffering right now. We've had two banking systems ever since the 1860s, with the state bank system and the federal bank system. And the federal bank system are the big Wall Street banks, particularly. They dominate the federal system. So they're taking over right now. I mean, in California, we don't even have any local banks where I am. They're now, we had two, and I had accounts in both of them, and they're now, one of them is Chase Bank and the other is U.S. Bank. So they're both big Wall Street banks now. They've been taken over. So if you can keep, it's the local banks that have an interest in serving the local business. The big banks have no interest in making loans to local business. It's too risky. Why should they bother? They've got this virtually free money they can get from the Fed and from each other. And it's much more lucrative to them either to speculate in commodities or other things abroad, or what works very well for them is to buy long-term government bonds at 3%, because these have no capital requirement. The capital requirement for government bonds are zero. So they can buy all of those that they want. Whereas if they buy, let's say, mortgages, or if they make loans for mortgages, or they make loans to businesses, then they have to worry about their capital requirement. And as soon as they've used up all their capital, in other words, you know, $8 of capital will get you $100 of loans, then they can't make any more loans. They have to wait for 30 years till those loans get paid off. So what they do, if they do buy mortgages, is sell them off to investors. And so that was the whole mortgage-backed security scam that we've seen. They had no motivation to make sure that these borrowers were actually sound borrowers. They just wanted to make a sale, so they sold the stuff to the unwary investors who might be somebody in Iceland or Sweden or pension funds. Yeah, so that didn't work out so well. So a state bank with the partnering with the local banks can provide the capital, can help them with capital. In North Dakota, the state bank guarantees the loans of the local banks, allowing them to make much bigger loans than they could otherwise. And the state bank provides liquidity to the small banks. That's why the small banks, the local banks, aren't making loans to small business right now, because they don't know that they can get money from the other banks as needed. The way banking works is they make the loan first. I mean, if you have credit lines to many different businesses, and if they all hit up their credit lines at once, you're going to run out of money. So you don't dare do that unless you know that you can get short-term loans from the other banks. And what's happening right now, even though there's $1.6 trillion in excess reserves sitting on the books of the big banks, they're not available to the little banks. And the reason is because the Fed is paying 0.25% interest on those reserves. So the banks have no incentive to lend them to the little banks. Why let go of them when you can make just as much keeping them, and then you still have your reserves and you can use them as collateral to buy bonds or something that'll make you more money? So the whole system is messed up. And in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota provides the liquidity for these local banks, so they can make loans to local business and for mortgages, the homeowners. And they also act as a buffer for the state bank. So the state bank is not really taking a risk with these loans. The state bank is not going to owe anything unless the local bank literally goes bankrupt. And they have not lost a single local bank in over, you know, at least a decade. That's as far back as we've seen the records. So it's a perfectly safe for the state bank. In fact, we got an idea recently. It seems that 97% of mortgages are now federally guaranteed. They're guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie. And so those loans are perfectly secure. The big Wall Street banks don't want to do mortgages because it'll tie up their capital. But a state bank could do that, and that would be like free money to the state. They could charge half the interest rate that the Wall Street banks are charging. It's guaranteed by the government, the federal government, so they're not taking any risk at all. So, and they've got plenty of deposits or plenty of revenues that they can turn into a deposit base. California would be the largest commercial bank in the world, or would be bigger than the largest commercial bank in the world if they were to form a state-owned bank, because they just have so much in the way of capital and so much in the way of potential deposits.
So, well, then you get the argument, well, this is not a stimulus bill, this is a spending bill. What do you think a stimulus is?
What? inflation heroes. Shout out to former President George Bush and Obama. This song is dedicated to all the inflation heroes out there, working tirelessly behind the scenes to steadily erode American dreams while devaluing our green. Bernanke, Alan Foster, Prosperity, Greenspan, DJ Clavis, Barack up on this track, proposing innovative ways to destroy our country's cash. I know it might sometimes make our dollars worth zero, but if we work hard enough, we can all be heroes. So here's my big idea and my first big thought. Let's bail out every banker, even the ones with the yachts. Let's spend them $700 billion and we'll call it a bailout. Crazy with inflation, freak America the hell out.
Absolutely, and I think it's a very important in the way that this is set up to once again ensure that the system isn't corrupted or taken off the rails by people who are in the interests of private financial interests who would seek to benefit from that type of system. But I think it can be set up in such a way to avoid that. And I understand that one of the things that the Public Banking Institute did before it was the Public Banking Institute, when it was still the Google Group, was really conduct a lot of research into the way that this idea has been tried in very many different places around the world. And personally, as a Canadian, I'm very much interested in the Bank of Canada and how that has been set up and how it functions now. Perhaps you can shed some light on that system or some of the other systems around the world that you've studied.
Yeah, I'm just now writing on that. I'm trying to finish a book on public banking and public banking historically. So the Bank of Canada is a really interesting case. And the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, they all, at one point, like in the 30s and 40s and 50s, lent the credit of the country. And they did amazing things with it. In Australia in 1912, they funded all kinds of businesses, shipping lines, etc. Unfortunately, they competed with the shipping line of the United Kingdom, which dominated the world at that time. So, and they funded World War One this way, just by issuing the credit of the Commonwealth Bank, which was the publicly owned central bank. Unlike our Federal Reserve, which was set up at the same time, the Commonwealth Bank is not at all owned by private parties. It's owned by the government, and it was run by a banker who understood how banking worked and knew that banks actually create credit on their books. And he chose to use that tool for the benefit of the public, which was an amazing thing. But in the 20s, the United Kingdom, the Bank of England and the City of London saw what a threat this was, this whole model where countries figured out that they could just issue their own credit and they didn't need the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth was colonizing. They had economically colonized what were formerly physical colonies. The colonies had independence, but they were still economically dependent. So the Reserve Bank of New Zealand did the same thing. They issued credit to, for example, build low-cost housing. It worked out very well because these were interest-free loans to themselves. And so that reduced the cost of the housing in half. And then they were making the rents from the housing. So it was a very profitable deal. And again, the City of London, the Commonwealth stepped in and said that they had to get with the program or that they were going to be cut off from the Commonwealth, from trade with the Commonwealth. And so the government, I guess, caved and started behaving more like a regular central bank, like a private bank or a bank that has to borrow from banks rather than just issuing credit. And Canada did the same thing. In the 1930s, when in 1935 it was first set up, they just issued credit and did some remarkable things, including funding the healthcare system in the 50s. That's how it got set up. But what happened there was in the 60s or 1971 was when the oil crisis. 71 was when the dollar went off the gold standard. And that was when there was this secret meeting of Henry Kissinger and the OPEC countries, and a deal was struck where Henry Kissinger said, supposedly, allegedly, we are going to make you very rich. We are going to quadruple the price of oil. But in return, you will sell your oil only in dollars, and you will put your dollars in our U.S. and London banks, and we will protect you militarily. That, so it is alleged that that's what happened. And the reason for this was because the dollar was no longer backed by gold, that it was rapidly collapsing. And so this was an emergency measure to back it now by oil instead of gold. Well, what happened was that quadrupling the price of gold meant that countries now had to have dollars. And so and currencies were floating, which allowed them to be manipulated. Anyway, you had this, what was called stagflation. So prices were going up, but the economy wasn't. And the real reason prices were going up was because of that, the quadrupling of the price of oil, which everybody depends on, of course. And there were big labor unions that were demanding higher wages, and big government was raising the prices of things. So there were these various factors driving prices up, but it was blamed on the government's printing money, which really wasn't what caused it, because the governments had been printing money for a long time and they didn't have that problem before. But, and then apparently there was just something happened, which nobody knows exactly, but these banks were, all the central banks were leaned on to not issue their own money, but to borrow privately from private banks. And that would be the big international banks, of course, which are now dominant.
So it strikes me that one of the key problems that people who are advocating for public banking face is really the ignorance of the general public on the historical analogs and the examples of how this has worked in the past. And I wonder, to what extent has our historical understanding of this concept been engineered out of our society? And to what extent could the reintroduction of this knowledge really help to expand people's awareness of the solutions to the problems that are facing us?
Yeah, I think education has been completely manipulated. It was manipulated by Rockefeller and Morgan. Morgan bought up the newspapers and Rockefeller bought up the universities, and they changed the curriculum so that there was no mention of many things. Like the Alberta Treasury branches, since you're from Canada, there was a whole social, for 25 years, Alberta was a social credit government. I mean, it wasn't really, they never really put the plan of C.H. Douglas into effect. But still, you don't hear, that's not in the history books at all. C.H. Douglas has been pretty much written out of the history books. But at the time, he was in the history. I mean, he was, like even Keynes, I think, was citing C.H. Douglas. I just read a book by Frances Hutchinson, which is quite good, on the whole social credit movement. It's her latest book. So that was all suppressed and changed, so that even though they had they did manage to elect a social credit government. It was another thing like now, where you had this grassroots movement. First, you had education. First, they had all these meetings that people just got together and they discussed, they had book clubs and discussions and figured out what was really going on. And so there was a grassroots push to change the government, and they managed to elect a social credit government. But then the politicians manipulated everything. That the federal government said that they couldn't do it, that only the federal government could print money. So then what the Alberta government did was, they came up with something called the Alberta Treasury branches, which was actually quite brilliant. It was very like the Bank of North Dakota. So this is the local provincial banking system. There was an ATB in every town. So as long as you got a premium for keeping your money in the ATB, and you paid a penalty if you withdrew money. So basically what they were doing was creating money on the books in the form of transfer credits. So it's sort of like when checks came in, it increased the money supply. So this transfers between the branches increased the money supply. So they did create money. And then the Bank of North Dakota, like all banks, creates money. But yeah.
Well, that's right. And I think what this gestures to is the idea that it's not the banks themselves that in and of themselves that are the problem. Again, like any sort of tool that can be used for good or evil purposes, it's the question of who's in control of that tool and what ends they're using it for. And I think that might be a difficult concept for a lot to understand, as I think the general public awareness of the problem has thankfully gotten to the level where people are starting to really question the monetary issue and the roots of the economic problems that we're facing. But it still raises the question of what kind of solutions are being offered and what kinds of ways people are being steered into moving. And so that raises for me the question, for example, what do you think of the End the Fed movement and the libertarians and Ron Paul and people like that who are advocating, of course, a return to the gold standard?
Well, like you say, it's absolutely not going to work. We've had a gold standard for hundreds of years, and it's never worked. They say that it has worked, but it hasn't. I mean, the only reason it worked at all was because of the paper money that expanded the system. And also there was what was called real bills, where businesses would turn their invoices into money. And so this is a way of expanding the money supply. But without that, if you were only trading in gold, you would quickly have a depression, because as long as you're lending 10 pieces of gold and you want 11 pieces back and you don't add more gold to the system, somebody has to default. And so you're going to continually have bankruptcies and foreclosures and depressions.
Okay, well then, moving on in a more positive direction, thinking about the Public Banking Institute and the types of alliances you're forming, what can you say about the different people who are arguing and advocating for this idea now, and the extent to which this idea is taking hold within the public and catching on?
Well, I think the first thing is education, and it is a difficult concept, because people originally say, well, I don't trust government. Why do we need more banks? You know, that sounds like socialism, something like that. So they don't understand the principle. So it's rather like social credit in Alberta. The first thing you have to do is have picnics and parties and explain this stuff. I mean, we don't do picnics, but we have the internet. And I keep writing articles and writing and writing. And to me, it's like keenly interesting anyway, because I want to know the answer too. So it's just like one big jigsaw puzzle, and I'm always finding another piece, and there's a potential chapter, and one chapter grows into another chapter, or one article grows into another article. So it's actually really interesting times, because I have this sort of instinctive sense that the answer is there. I mean, we're meant to be living in prosperity and abundance, and the only thing stopping that is a messed up system. I mean, we're living in a parasitic system. If you could get rid of the parasite, we'd be blossoming into something, into the next level of civilization, the level that we should have been at or could be at, our potential. So I see, even though we're living in scary times, I see it as a positive, because you have to go through, it's during periods of change or during periods of stress when things fall apart that you come up, that you have the potential of creating something new. I have a website, webofdebt.com, and publicbankinginstitute.org, and yeah, I have a blog connected to my website.
Thanks for your interest, folks. You heard Alan Brown, interviewed courtesy of James Corbett from grtv.ca. And Alan's blog is worth visiting. It's quite interesting, as it has articles just very recently published. Check it out, folks. The music was Fine Line, Subprime Decline, The Richter Scales, American Economy Rap, an excerpt of Another Day, Another Dollar by Wayne Stewart, an excerpt of 2009 Economic Crisis, the Inflation Nation theme song, and also music by Keith Jarrett. This was Kaput Radio. My name is Martin. Check me out next time.